Accession number 13358, Mr. H. Wilkinson, Reel 11.
Mr. H. Wilkinson, Reel 11. Have you any other memories of Africa, Mr. Wilkinson?
Just that while we were en route with this sergeant to go to the port of Algiers to get a ship, we'd had a bit of a run-in at this camp where we'd rested. And they were trying to treat us all like rookies. And they must have thought we were absolutely doolally. But it turned out to be the other way. We had a bit of rumpus with them, and I'm certain that they were that damn awkward that they delayed our transport so much that, in effect, when we got to Algiers, which is right high up above the port itself, it was evening, and the ship was going out, and it hadn't been long left the docks. And it was steaming away, and that was the ship we should have been on.
This camp that you'd rested in, was it made up of men that had done any fighting in Africa?
I don't think so. They seemed to be more or less like second-liners or rookies making the numbers up, you know.
But, did it lead to any physical arguments?
I think there have been fists flying in a few instances, but they certainly got told where to get off. Right. So we were back to the camp, Mays and Kerry, and things more or less as before, although I don't think there was so many light, so heavy duties. They seemed lighter. And in due course, we did get a ship home. And
what time would this be?
Well, it'd be, a week. As near as I can tell you, a week or so after that instance. I know that I arrived home Christmas Eve unexpected, but en route, we'd gone through the Straits of Gibraltar. And as we got outside, a mile or two, I'd just had lunch and come up onto the sun deck and was looking out through the big glass windows at the side. And the ship was heading straight for us. I thought, oh no, it can't be. And it kept coming. And I saw there was no alternative. It was going to hit us. And I shouted to some of the chaps, down. I threw myself down. Some threw themselves down, some got flung down, and there was an almighty bang and a scrape, and you could hear all the crockery going and God knows what. And it seemed as though she went down to the gunwales one side and back over again, and right, rock and roll. Anyway, after a few moments, we scrambled up and got on deck. When we got on deck, the side that had been struck was like a mountain, well stove into the side, and really like a big hill. And all the lifeboats and that had been scraped off as she'd gone along. Eventually it turned out that something had gone wrong with the steering, and I believe everybody called her the Drunken Duchess. I'm not sure whether it was the Duchess of Richmond or what ship it was now that hit us. I know it made a right mess.
Was this part of the convoy you were in, or a ship going another direction?
No, there was only the ship. And we had two corvettes as escort. I mean, the main unit had gone before. And we tried to carry on, but the starter singled in, and our ship had to about turn and go into dock in Gibraltar.
Was anyone hurt?
I never heard of anyone being hurt. Maybe a few cuts and bruises, but nothing drastic that I know of. Anyway, we put into Gibraltar for 10 days. We were in there for 10 days while they filled her up with concrete. She was leaking.
Did you get off the ship?
No. I'm not sure that we'd been allowed ashore for an hour or two, and something was contrary and we had to get back on board, but I think we were on board most of 10 days. I think they used to run a competition whereby you could guess the date that we'd sail or guess the date that we'd get into Blighty. Other than that, it was crown and anchor, cards, drafts, whatever.
Was it a crowded vessel?
Yes, yes, it was crowded. I think it was made up of lots of other units that had come under the same conditions or circumstances. And I also remember after we did finally leave Gib, we got out into the sea, and the waves came pretty strong and hard. We didn't half hit the bad weather. The corvettes, you could see that you couldn't see the top of the mast one moment, and the next moment you'd see them perched on top of a wave, bone stern, fully exposed, and the propellers throbbing away. You could hear it right across, you know, right rattle. Anyway, seasickness crept in quite a lot with most people. I know I'd been on the mess deck this particular lunchtime, and as I was coming up to get on the deck, there was a chap coming down with a big tray of custard, I think it was, doing orderly. And he was looking green about the gills as he was coming towards me, and all of a sudden he couldn't help himself. He threw up right in all the custard. Then there's these, like, at the side where he was, it looked like a camp boiler, like a Sawyer boiler, a metal construction. And he lifted the lid to pour it down, but it was the wrong side of the ship. He should have poured it down on the other side. The draft up here blew it all over him, and oh, what a blinking mess. Poor sod. I got out the ruddy road. I couldn't face any more.
Was it a restful journey for you?
More or less, apart from the storms. The waves must have been 60, 80 feet high, Harry. Oh, it was a hell of a do. And we eventually got to Liverpool. And
what was the reception like at Liverpool?
Well, it was just dockside, really. You disembarked.
There was no one there to play you off on?
Oh, no, nothing like that. No, no. I believe slept on, like, wire beds with no mattresses or anything on until I was able to get to a station and head home. And I got in, I think it would be 11 o'clock Christmas Eve, unexpected.
You went straight home?
More or less, yes. We were issued with our chitties and that the next morning, you know, and travel warrants and what have you.
What kind of reception did you get at home?
Well, I just knocked at the door and walked in. It was just before midnight, Christmas Eve. Everybody was surprised, wondered who was knocking at the door at that time of night. Of course, it was dark, and that was it.
How long was your leave?
I think it was fortnight. I think it was a fortnight, Harry. I'll go along with that anyway, or maybe 10 days or a fortnight.
Over the fortnight, what were you doing?
Oh, just sort of trying to become one of the family. And during the daytime, meeting old friends and any of chaps of my age that had gone into the forces or maybe on leave. I did meet one or two chaps that had joined the Air Force, actually. I had a cousin. He joined the Air Force. He ended up with the FC in Bar. He was on these big aircraft, Pathfinders. That's right, Pathfinders. He did a double tour of duty. He came back, but there's a lot of the lads in my hometown, both Army, one or two Navy, and quite a few Air Force that never came back.
Did you experience anyone coming to you to ask if you'd seen their relative that didn't come back? Did you see him killed, anything of that nature?
Just one, yes. And he'd been my sniper sergeant, and he had come back.
What was his name?
I think it was Stuart. I'm not sure whether it's Stuart or Stuart Petch. But that's a long time ago, and I think I only met with a relative in the first instance shortly after coming out of the army, and haven't seen since. So whether they're dead or alive now, I don't know.
At the end of your leave, where did you go to?
I believe it was a place called Shudi Camps. But I haven't a great recollection. I remember Shudi and some training we did there. And I also remember Lowestoft. The thing about it was I remembered the boats and the masts sticking up. You could see them, you know, from various areas in the street or the town. And that seems to be faint.
Had you got your medal ribbon?
Oh, yes. We got issued with that on the boat coming over. We always said it came up with the Navy rations.
Yeah. This is the campaign medal with the number 8.
That's right. It's on that photograph.
You were quite veterans, of course, in this area. Many of the units around you had never been out of England.
No.
Do you recall how you got on with those units?
Well, in my own experience, never seemed to have any bother. No.
What was the discipline like in the battalion after being abroad for so long? They'd been abroad some 3 years by then.
Yes. Uh-huh. Well, I think it was more or less restored to the type of training that you expected to perform in the various units and camps within our own country. It had a different air about it, like that, you know. We were more seemed to be more disciplined when it came to actual training.
How did you take to that?
Well, you just buckled down to it, that's all. You knew there was a job coming up somewhere along the line. You didn't know exactly what date or anything until it was issued to you just prior to going aboard ship. But
were there new regulations on dress that had to be enforced? Because in the desert it would have been very casual.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, it was on account of the heat and that, you know, but you conformed as to previous. Your khaki compared to your KD and all your other recruitments.
Many people like yourself come back after 3 years, and you're in England and had a very short leave.
Yes.
What was it? Was there a temptation to go home when you shouldn't have gone home?
I think one or two of the chaps looked at it that way. I believe there was one or two that went AWOL. I didn't. I like to keep my nose clean as far as possible.
What are your next memories of what you did?
As from Shudi and Lowestoft, going on down to a place called Nursling, about 4 miles out of Southampton, on the main Southampton to Winchester Road. We went into a strip of forest land. It came to a point where it actually came to the verge of the roadside. And it was a land belonging to Lord Mountbatten, Nightingale Woods, in Canvas there. And as time went on and it grew nearer towards June the 6th, all our transport was taken across the road to this little estate. You went in at right angles, opposite side of the road, and each side of the opening to this estate, I believe there was a double block of semi-detached, and you went on through, and it became a complete circle of bungalows on the outer side, and a complete inner circle of bungalows. Very pretty. Yes, very pretty. A lot of flowers, the gardens were well looked after. And as you went in on the right, there was a crescent strip of green grass, and the bungalows were set a little bit farther back towards this side of the circle. And we used to go there and do guards on the transport that was being all doctored up and sealed, waterproofed, ready for the big do. And I was on duty this particular evening, and I'd just come off my stint when this lady approached the fence and looked over to where we were laid on our ground sheets. And she said, "Would any of you chaps like a hot bath?" Silence fell. Everybody looked at each other, and they kept looking at the lady, and dead silent. So I piped up to the corporal. I said, "Well, would it be possible for me to have a bath? I'd appreciate one." And she said, "You're welcome, if it's all right." And the corporal said, "Well, you've just come off. You've got quite a spell of time." So I availed myself of the offer. She was a tall lady, very pretty, and she took me into the bungalow, and she had three beautiful children, and they were all curly haired. I think one would be about 5, another about 3, and one maybe coming up to about a year, a little boy. And they were all in the bath, and the right picture. And when she got them out and dried them off, she ran the bath for me. I went and had a jolly good soak, and I enjoyed it. And when I came out and she saw the state of my feet, she got some talcum powder and some slippers, talc my feet and put the slippers on. And in actual fact, she was a major's wife, and he used to work on the Isle of Wight. And he had been a busily shot. He'd been a major. And I did meet him. And he's a fine fellow. And made me most welcome. And he had a room where he used to make his own wines. In fact, she made them, I think. But they had this room full of wines in various stages of fermentation. And he also had a gun room. And he took me into there, and it was, I think he must have had about a dozen or so weapons. And he had a good long lawn at the back of the bungalow. And he'd get the rifles down, some 22s, and we'd go and have some target practice. And he taught me more about the rifle and how to handle it, I think, than the army had done all the time. He says, to hell with all that bullshit about spreading your legs at a certain angle. He said, if there's anybody kicking your heels, well, conform, but if there's nobody watching, try and get away with it. He says, you adapt yourself to the land to make yourself most comfortable as you can and take it from there. Then use your drill. And that's what I did. It eventually got me into the sniper platoon.
Pardon me. You must have visited them on a number of occasions after that.
Oh, yes, yes. I used to go at weekends when he came home. I didn't want any scandal. with a really nice family, and we've kept in contact ever since. Now she's very old and she can't come up, but we used to exchange visits, and he died rather prematurely. I think she'll be about approaching the 90s, I should think. But I was just a young swaddy, and they were more or less
What's the name of the family?
Mr. and Mrs. Haynes, yes.
You mentioned the fact that transport was being proofed in
yes.
that area.
Yes.
The civilians in the houses must have known that this was going on.
Well, they can't have been that green that they couldn't see that something was going on. But whether there'd been any military silence imposed upon them, I don't know. Or whether they'd been talked to at all, I don't know. It had to be done somewhere, and it couldn't all be done in the forest itself, so it was round there, but there was guards on all the time.
Had you done any training for landing onto beaches?
I remember the sea and sand dunes, and these exercises going on, but I can't exactly pinpoint them as to what part of the coast it was. I'm afraid I can't know. But I made friends with another family farther round on that estate, and we've been friends with them ever since. But Mr. Haynes died quite prematurely in relation to his wife, and I think it'll be about maybe four years or so since this other gentleman died.
In the camp itself, what were the conditions like?
Well, pretty basic, really. I mean, it was just like being under canvas anyway. I mean, you weren't in a camp where there was brick buildings or anything like that. There's no Nissen huts that I can recall, unless there was a kitchen somewhere. Probably would be, but I can't remember what part of the camp it was now. No.
As the invasion day neared, what happened to you in the camp?
Well, it came to a battalion shoot, and I'd been operating more or less as Major Haynes had told me to, and a bit of this practice on his lawn and one thing and another. I was down to the finals, and I think, really speaking, one or two of the officers were a bit jealous because I was beating them all with the rifle. So in fact I eventually won it. And there was a bit of a purse, I can't recall how much it was, but in those days, and with what you got at army pay, it was most welcome. However, when we came in off the chute, I remember going to my tent, and the chap says, "What the hell are you doing here, Wilk?" I said, "Well, you know you're deaf, so-and-so is what I'm doing here." I said, "I'm going to boil my rifle out, get cleaned up, and go and read orders." He said, "Well, we've read them. You should have read them first. You're not with us anymore." I said, "No, No, you've got to report to the sniper platoon. So that was it. Mind, I must admit, it was interesting training. It was quite a break from the usual.
What was the training of a sniper person?
Well, I found it quite relaxing and quite different to the ordinary training we'd been doing prior to going into the sniper section. And we were basically taught to keep our weapons spotless, absolutely. Every occasion we got to check it over and see that it was nice and easy and free from grit and dirt. The ammunition also had to be highly polished, kept clean.
And were there regular inspections of this?
Yes, not insofar as you were lined up, but as you were cleaning and looking after your weapons, maintaining them, the sergeant used to come round and maybe stand and watch you and maybe have a relative point he'd like to raise with you or anything like that, or a question he'd like to fling at you. Or he'd get down beside you and examine your weapon really closely and strike a position whereby, a firing position we'll say, and he'd look down the rifle and check it as far as he could and comment whether it was all right or whether he thought anything else could be done to it. He'd check your ammunition over.
Were they regularly checked for accuracy?
Oh, yes. Zeroed? Yes, you'd have them zeroed, yes. If you went out and fired just to see how they were performing, if they were necessary, you would take it to the armourer. And all the sights and everything would be checked, you'd be spot on. Well, you couldn't afford to miss, really. Lots of the situation, you definitely couldn't.
So what was the next piece? You looked after your weapons, then what came?
Well, you had a bit of training. You'd go out and the sergeant would maybe take somebody with him, or maybe one or two of the section itself, and one would have to try and find the other and maybe fire a blank to register the fact that you'd spotted them. And that signified a hit. Other than that, as soon as you'd done that, the first chance you got, you cleaned that weapon, because blanks tend to be relatively dirty. They fire that paper and that out of the end, you know, and it makes the barrels rather sticky, I think, and blackened. And you also went out to make a hide, and you were taught how to use various bits of the vegetation, type of tree or bush or even grasses that were local to that situation, and you avail yourself of the hedgerow cover and what have you. You stuck it in your webbing and bits in your helmet. You had a green net over, and from then on you progressed as best you could without being found.
Moving across the ground, was that done slowly or how?
Well, if it was possible, you used your common sense, and if you thought it was relatively easy to progress at a quick pace for a few yards, maybe 20, 50 or whatever, to get to some really good cover, you'd probably take a chance on that. And then from then on, you'd be far more cautious and crawl very steadily so that you were hardly moving at times, just to enable yourself to get to a good position and make a good hide.
What would be a good hide?
Well, it would be somewhere just ahead of a hedgerow, maybe, or quite a few yards in advance of that, but easy enough to get back to cover if ever you were likely to be spotted. And so that you had a good vision yourself of anything that might be moving in front of you or around in your line of fire. I think that's relatively all I can say about the training.
Did you go out singly?
Oh, yes. Yes. I never went out with anybody else, no.
And going out, was that during the day or did you go out at night ready for dawn?
Well, we went out maybe towards dawn. Maybe it was breaking first light. you had your hide well marked, you know, you knew by the certain positions of trees or whatever, landmarks, where to head for, and then you knew where your hide was, and you got flat down and into it.